It is Friday, October the 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. Many thanks for joining us today. Coming up, U.S. leader calling on all Americans to fight opioid crisis.
Each of us has a responsibility to this effort. We have a total responsibility to ourselves, to our family, to our country.
The U.S. response to the plight of the Rohingyas, standoff between Spain and Catalonia, plus the passing of a musical legend.
There is nothing.
Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. In personal terms, because his brother died of an alcohol addiction, President Trump on Thursday pledged to overcome addiction in the U.S., declaring opioid abuse a national public health emergency, which he describes as the worst drug crisis in American history. Mr. Trump's declaration, which will be effective for 90 days and can be renewed, will allow the government to redirect resources in various ways.
There is nothing admirable, positive, or socially desirable about it. There is nothing desirable about drugs. They're bad. We want the next generation of young Americans to know the blessings of a drug-free life. In this enormous struggle against drug addiction and opioid epidemic, it really is that. It is an epidemic. Our greatest hope is the same as it has always been. Through every trial America has encountered throughout our history, the spirit of our people and the strength of our character, we win. Each of us has a responsibility to this effort. We have a total responsibility to ourselves, to our family, to our country, including those who are struggling with this addiction.
Some have criticized President Trump's call for an end to the opioid addiction because he did not pledge to commit any new money to the fight, a scourge that has killed nearly 175 people each day last year in the U.S. Mr. Trump is promising a massive advertising campaign, as he put it, part of his administration's response to the opioid crisis.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News.
Also in the news, Britain has circulated a draft UN resolution that would condemn the violence that has sent more than 600,000 Rohingya Muslims fleeing from Myanmar to Bangladesh and called on the Myanmar government, of which Aung San Suu Kyi is the de facto leader, to immediately halt military operations in Rakhine State, where so many Rohingyas have been under assault from the military in Myanmar since the August 25th attack by Rohingya rebels that sparked the violence. Conditions in camps in Bangladesh are at best deplorable, according to many observers. Rohingya have to wait in extremely long lines for food and water, and the number of cases of cholera are on the rise. Meantime, U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of the state of Illinois and several other senators just met at the U.S. Capitol with Myanmar's ambassador to the U.S. to talk about all of this. For VOA, Greta Van Susteren sat down with Senator Durbin, who told her many of his colleagues and others feel an ethnic cleansing is going on in Myanmar directed at the Rohingyas. Durbin was asked why this crisis should be important to the American people.
When it comes to American greatness, one of the things that we point to is when we stand up for things, values that count all around the world. These people, Muslim people, Rohingya people, are being terrorized by the Myanmar military. Their homes are being burned. They're being killed and raped and displaced in hundreds of thousands of numbers. They're put into refugee camps across the Naf River in Bangladesh and live under the worst, most deplorable, dangerous conditions. That's just unacceptable.
Well, according to the law in Burma, Myanmar, is in 1982, when they gave a number of ethnic groups citizenship, they specifically eliminated the Rohingyas. Why are they so resistant to letting the Rohingyas occupy that area?
Their argument, as I understand it, is they're not really citizens of Burma or Myanmar. They're really from Bangladesh. They are Bengali. And secondly, I don't think it escapes attention, they are Muslim. in a country where there is a Muslim population, but they are a concentration of a million or more Muslims within that country that has never been assimilated or accepted.
Well, apparently some of the people in the military in Myanmar say that these are terrorists.
And there was a terrorist incident, or at least a killing. You can characterize it as you wish. 16, we understand, Myanmar soldiers or law enforcement were killed. It was after some exchanges, some killing on both sides. But to argue that the response to that should be the displacement of 600,000 people is an outrage. It really went way beyond calling to justice those who are responsible, and it clearly is ethnic cleansing by classic definition.
And you're speaking about the August 25th attack, and since then all these people, they basically had a scorched earth policy, and there's been rape, there have been villages burned down, and they're trying to push them out of the Rakhine area of Myanmar.
Yes, the northern Rakhine in particular. You know, we invited seven senators, Democrats and Republicans, invited the ambassador from Myanmar to come to my office yesterday, and he sat with us for over an hour and took our questions, and we'll get back to us in a week or two about his progress. What we're trying to do is to tell him we are watching carefully. Any relationship we have with Myanmar is going to be dependent on the outcome of this situation, and we expect results quickly.
Well, you've introduced a resolution condemning it, and you had bipartisan support?
I believe we will.
You have legislation coming.
I can tell you that the original resolution, John McCain joined me, and we think others will too. Yes, it will be bipartisan. But we don't want to wait for the passage of this resolution, as symbolic as it may be. We want results. I mean, there are people who are suffering at this point and dying. And we called on this government, called on Aung San Suu Kyi, to really step up, speak up, and do something. First, bring in some third parties, United Nations, NGOs, into Northern Rakhine, where they are currently being excluded, so they can see on the ground what's happening. Second, hold those responsible in the Myanmar military who burned these villages and were involved in these atrocities. Third, if there's going to be repatriation, bring in the UNHCR, the High Commission on Refugees, to bring these people back in an orderly way, demanding papers from people who have been completely displaced from their homes and their homes burned in front of them is unrealistic.
Aung San Suu Kyi, there was so much hope that she would be the one who had answered this or solved this problem, or at least to pull back some of the oppression of the Rohingyas. She had the Nobel Peace Prize. She was a secret pen pal to Laura Bush when she was First Lady of the United States. There are some headlines that say she's complicit because she has failed to speak so to condemn this. What's your thought on Aung San Suu Kyi?
I admire her so much. I mean, there she was under house arrest for more than a decade, just determined to stand up for what she thought was the beginning of a democracy in her country, and she prevailed. She has a position of leadership. She's far from the strong leader that that country needs. They're in transition from military control to democracy. It's been less than 2 years that they've been at it. But she needs to be much more forceful and forthcoming when it comes to this atrocity within her own country.
That is U.S. Senator Dick Durbin speaking with Greta Van Susteren. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter. Every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in. Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. The standoff between Spain and Catalonia over the region's bid to secede went down to the wire on Thursday as the Spanish government prepared to strip away Catalan regional powers after President Carlos Puigdemont scrapped hopes of early elections that might have ended the country's worst political crisis in decades. The Spanish Senate is set to take that unprecedented move of imposing direct rule and do so later today of Catalonia, despite threats of mass civil disobedience and possible violence there. Monash University senior lecturer Carlos Uxo tells VOA's Victor Beatty, nothing will dissuade the Senate from voting to dismiss the regional government and imposing direct rule.
To be approved, you need the majority in the Senate, and the ruling party, the Partido Popular, has that majority, so they don't even need to discuss with other parties. They have said that it will go ahead no matter what the Catalan government does, and yes, it will be happening on Saturday.
Do you anticipate that if the Catalonian regional authority decides to call a snap election, would that divert direct rule?
The Partido Popular has said that that will not stop Article 155 going ahead, which means that there will be direct rule by Saturday. In turn, the Catalan government, because now they know that Article 155 is going to be applied, the president of the Catalan government has decided not to go to the Spanish Senate to present his case, because obviously the decision has already been made.
Could this all have been avoided? Both sides apparently have played this badly. Is that your view?
It is my view, and I have the feeling that it's the view of the majority of people in Spain, and I'm afraid also the majority of people in Catalonia. In the last week, the Catalan government, or the president of the Catalan government, received an invitation to speak in the Senate, but even the setting when he could speak became an issue, which means that basically neither of both sides are really ready to engage in a real dialogue. I think they are more interested at this stage in defending their views rather than trying to come out of this stalemate.
Carlos, Catalan authorities have been rather cagey or murky in declaring this independence. Have they in fact declared independence or not?
Well, that is the most difficult question to be answered. Carles Puigdemont, the Catalan president, gave a speech that probably will be studied in the future as an example of how not to say what you want to say, but you are saying what you don't want to say at the same time. In the end, nobody knew if he had declared independence. I think that to some extent it could have been seen as a good political move, trying to delay a final decision to try to engage in more dialogue, but that has not eventuated. The fact is that not in the parliament, but outside in another session, a parallel session, parliamentarians, members of three parties in Catalonia, they did sign a declaration of independence. The document is there. It is signed. It just needs to be validated.
That is Monash University's Carlos Uxo speaking with VOA's Victor Beattie. About 200 undocumented migrants of Moroccan and sub-Saharan origin were intercepted on 9 dinghies in the Strait of Gibraltar and the Almirón Sea off the Spanish coastline recently. A growing number of migrants are using Morocco as a launching pad to begin a new life in Europe, entering through Spain, which is very close by. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about this increasingly popular migration route.
Well, we're seeing an increase in the number of migrants coming from North Africa into these Spanish enclaves, particularly because the route between Libya and Italy has slowed down considerably in recent months. Now, about 400 migrants arrived aboard about 20 boats in the last few days. Moroccan security forces were also deployed around the border on Tuesday morning after 50 migrants from sub-Saharan Africa tried to clamber up fences in a bid to get to Spain through the Tarajal border crossing. So we're seeing this increased activity. On Saturday, about 198 undocumented migrants of Moroccan and sub-Saharan origins were also intercepted on dinghies in the Strait of Gibraltar and the sea off Almeria. So this is really quite a big trend that we're seeing as migrants are still desperate to get to Europe.
You know, it seems like the migrants now are hoping to use this route from Morocco as a launch pad to begin new lives in Europe going into Spain, which, as you mentioned, is only about 10 miles across the sea. I understand this is alarming the Spanish authorities.
Yes, indeed. And the migrant centers are apparently quite overcrowded in southern Spain, and we've even heard reports that they're close to collapse because of the influx. Since the beginning of October, at least 1,000 migrants have arrived in the Andalusia region, and the temporary holding centres seem to be full to capacity. We've also seen migrants abandoned. Spanish Guardia Civil divers recovered a corpse near the Melilla port of a young man the other day who drowned after the boat he was travelling in with around 24 other people was abandoned at sea by traffickers. So this new route is of concern, and no doubt the authorities will be monitoring the movement of migrants very closely, and particularly the concern too about the traffickers themselves, who appear to have no concern about the fate of these migrants and are no trouble about abandoning them in the middle of the Mediterranean in very difficult conditions.
Is there any count yet on the number of children that are involved in this particular route?
I haven't seen any figures on the number of children involved, but in the past year, over 10,000 undocumented migrants have arrived on Spanish coast. In 2016, fewer than 6,000 had arrived for the whole year. So that gives you some idea of the increase that we're seeing. And the numbers are still far below the migrant flows that we've seen in Italy from Libya, the main concern for the EU and other European countries. But European officials are worried about the increase in this route. Frontex, the European Border Agency, has described its concern about what it calls a steady increase in irregular migration across the Western Mediterranean route. The authorities will be watching this route very closely. And it's unusual, too, that even so late in the year, there's no sign of a slowdown in the numbers that really want to reach Europe.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program Africa News Tonight. Time now to take a look at what's happening in the world of social media. Here's VOA's Andrew Palchevsky.
For months, we've been talking about Russian interference on U.S. social media, particularly Russian influence during the 2016 U.S. presidential election. And while many of the stories we've talked about up until now have been about uncovering the depth and scope of this interference, we're beginning to see stories now where social networks are striking back. So today, we're looking at Twitter and some changes that they're making to their practices to try to stop Russian interference in the future. Twitter is creating a so-called transparency center. It's going to show users what specific entities are advertising on Twitter, how long certain ads have been running, how much money has been spent on ads, and the demographic groups that advertisers are targeting. This is going to be rolling out soon in the US, and eventually it's going to roll out worldwide. Now, those criteria were not chosen by accident, things like demographics and ad money. They actually mirror the Honest Ads Act. This was a bill introduced in the U.S. Senate last week that would require social media companies to provide information on their advertising to their users. So it seems like Twitter is getting a jump on that even before that legislation's being voted on. The hope is that more information and more restrictions on ads will limit the influence that foreign countries or entities can have on U.S. opinion and discourse. And following up that announcement about this transparency center, Twitter announced on Thursday that it is banning RT, formerly known as Russia Today, and its digital channel Sputnik from advertising on the platform. Those channels will still be able to tweet, but they won't be able to promote their content. For months, people have cited RT as a source of Russian propaganda rather than a legitimate news source, including the U.S. Director of National Intelligence. He said earlier this year that RT was one of the ways that Russia was trying to infiltrate Western media. Now, as part of this announcement, Twitter said that RT had spent nearly $2 million U.S. dollars on ads in the past 6 years, including over $250,000 during the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Twitter now says they're going to take that money and donate it to their ongoing efforts to research and fight misinformation on social media.
Thank you very much, Andrew. VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
Spain is considered the world's top exporter of wine, shipping more than 20 million hectoliters every year. And now a group of drink makers in Bilbao, Spain, want to add to the red and whites with a new kind of wine, blue wine. Tay McCarthy is one of the creators of Gick Live.
Some might say sweet, some might say not sweet enough. We think it's just easy to drink, which is what we're going for.
It looks like wine, blue as it is, but Gick Live drink makers are barred from calling it wine by the European Union because of its color. Still, wine drinker Maddie Goller finds the drink interesting.
The color was interesting. I've never seen blue wine before, and I really like my wine, so that was, it was fun.
The blue color comes from extracting a pigment from the skin of the grape. Made the same way as wine, GIC Live has sold 400,000 bottles of their organic drink to 25 countries. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexiou.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In our report from the music department, he was known as the godfather of rock and roll, a performer who always gave all he had, a man who loved his city and his neighborhood, and tributes are accumulating in words and in bouquets of flowers left at his New Orleans, Louisiana home. For more on Fats Domino, who sadly died this week at the age of 89, here's my colleague, Sarah Williams.
Nikki Strong of VOA 1 is here to talk about his life and music. Tell us about Fats Domino's legacy.
Well, he was one of the mighty architects of rock and roll, one of its biggest stars, hands down. He was actually Elvis Presley's main rival. By the end of his career, Domino sold more records than any other 1950s rocker, except for Elvis Presley. And there's an interesting story with Elvis that he and Fats Domino were in the same room together. The press were interviewing Elvis, and one reporter refers to Elvis as the king. And he interrupts the reporter, and he points to Fats Domino, and he says, "There's the real king of rock and roll." And he also, I think in one of his shows in Las Vegas, it was, he started his concert by saying, "This gentleman," he introduced Fats Domino, and he said, "This gentleman was a huge influence on me when I started out." And Fats Domino was a critical influence on music in general of the 1960s and 70s. His million-selling debut single, The Fat Man, on Imperial Records, has been cited as the first rock and roll record to achieve that level of sales success. Mm. He was from New Orleans, and so the sounds of New Orleans informed his music, especially the syncopated second line rhythms, which is usually associated with the brass band parades in New Orleans. He was also known for his boogie-woogie piano. That was a major influence of his music. And he had his trademark triplets. And these triplets became so popular that they wound up being copied in so many rock and roll ballads at the time. It's like they became standard. Like, you had to have a triplet, you know, and he popularized that technique. He was also one of the first R&B artists to cross over and gain popularity with white audiences. He helped create one of the first R&B songs to cross over to the pop chart, Lottie, Miss Claudie. Because his shows attracted both whites and blacks, his music became a factor in the breakdown of racial segregation in the U.S. And many white artists got huge boost in their careers by recording his hits, you know, as well. So case in point, in 1955, Ain't It a Shame became a number one hit for Pat Boone as Ain't That a Shame. And he would also just also cover other songs and make it his own and put his own stamp on it. Blueberry Hill, for example, was not one of his original songs. It was first done in 1940. It had been recorded by Glenn Miller and Louis Armstrong, but his version in 1956, complete with those triplets, became humongous. It was huge. And he was also known for just singing like wordless lyrics, like wah, 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 and woo, and he did it like nobody else can. So yeah, a rich legacy indeed.
Well, he started his career as a teenager.
He did. He grew up around music. He was the child of Haitian Creole plantation workers and the grandson of a slave. His brother-in-law, Harrison Verrett, is a traditional jazz musician and gave him one of his first piano lessons. And from there, it was history. He fell in love and devoted himself to the craft. So he was primarily self-taught. He studied a lot of the boogie-woogie hits at that time, a lot of the boogie-woogie legends. He would teach himself how to play everyone's records, he said. He would hear it, and he would learn how to play it. And he taught himself a lot by ear. He said he had a good ear for catching notes. He dropped out of school in fourth grade. He worked as an Iceman helper. And he said in houses where there were pianos, he would play. And that is actually how he practiced. In his teens, he started working at a club called The Hideaway. The Hideaway, with a band led by the bassist Billy Diamond, who nicknamed him Fats. That's where he got his nickname. And so he soon became the band's frontman and a local draw. And then Dave Bartholomew saw him, and he was like, he was incredible. You know, it's just, he had the audience in the palm of his hand. It was just a huge party. And he got him signed to Imperial Records. And those two collaborated until, I think, about 1963, and just produced hit after hit after hit. In 1986, Fats Domino was one of the first musicians to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he also received the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award that year. And in 1998, President Bill Clinton awarded him the National Medal of the Arts. He also had a very, like, unassuming, shy way about him. And because of that, many people think people may be aware of Fats Domino, but unaware of how large of a contribution he's actually made to rock and roll.
Thanks, Nikki. Well, you can hear more great music by artists influenced by Domino's legacy on VOA 1 The Hits. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
You made me cry when you said goodbye. Ain't that a shame? My tears feel like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame. You broke my heart when you said we'll part. Ain't that a shame? Tears feel like rain.
That might have been a big hit for Pat Boone. Listen, he was a great singer as well, but let me tell you, Ain't That a Shame was a super hit for Fats Domino, always has been associated with him. Listen, many thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director Tracy Carter and engineer Zainab Abdelrahman, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday. Now a bit more from Fats Domino.
You said goodbye. Ain't that a shame? My tears feel like rain. Ain't that a shame? You're the one to blame. Oh well, goodbye. Although I cry.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters, most recently in the northeastern town of Damasak. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Sikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shekau. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net. Or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.